Knowing that the ban is a possible result of a prejudice against transgender individuals makes it hard for many of us to feel safe in our own identity.
More people have voted on marriage equality in Australia than voted for the American president or the French presidential elections.
This is not something that really has been championed or spearheaded by politicians in Australia. This is something that actually has been driven by grassroots people, and I think it's one of the great achievements of LGBTIQ people and their friends and families and supporters.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Central Asia's anti-queer purge spreads to Tajikistan, a trans teen takes on Trump's military ban, and Australian activists rally for final yes votes in marriage equality plebiscite. Those stories and more this week, because you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending October 21st, 2017. Tajikistan has joined the list of countries in Central Asia to launch attacks on sexual minorities. The state prosecutor's office announced this week that it had compiled a list of 367 gay and lesbian people who were put on a register due to their vulnerability in society and for their safety, and to prevent the transmission of sexually transmitted diseases. The prosecutor's announcement said that 319 gay men and 48 lesbians in the former Soviet Republic were identified by federal prosecutors and the Interior Ministry as a result of what they called research into the LGBT community called Purge and Morality that began last year. No research methodology was described, however. The announcement also said that people on the list would be subject to regular medical testing for STDs, although exactly what kind of testing also wasn't specified. Any transgender people on the list were not identified as such. Tajikistan decriminalized same-gender sex in 1998 after the fall of the Soviet Union, but bias and abuse are entrenched in the mostly Muslim nation of almost 9 million people. The predominantly Russian Republic of Chechnya seems to have sparked the growing global purge of LGBTQ people in April when it began its now infamous genocidal crackdown on gay and bisexual men. Azerbaijan, another former Soviet satellite in Central Asia with a similar mostly Muslim demographic, was condemned last week by the United Nations for its recent anti-queer crackdown that has thus far netted more than 80 people. Indonesia and Egypt were also criticized by the UN for their continuing efforts to suppress LGBTQ people through routine police raids on suspected gay gatherings.
A bill that's one step away from being made law in the Central Asian nation of Kyrgyzstan will ban propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations, a near duplicate of the notorious No Promo Homo statute in Russia that outlaws any public support for sexual and gender-variant minorities. The government has already pressured the landlord of the country's only nightclub that regularly hosted LGBT people to shut it down. London, located on the outskirts of the capital city of Bishkek, had been a Saturday night tradition for LGBT people for several years. According to Labrys, one of Kyrgyzstan's leading LGBT rights groups, the increasingly hostile environment in the country has led to a threefold spike in reported anti-queer attacks. Bishkek's reputation as one of the most progressive cities in Central Asia began to evaporate in 2014 when the government launched a series of reforms aimed at reversing years of steadily increasing pro-Western values. Kyrgyzstan's No Promo Homo Bill is awaiting its third and final reading.
The Central South American country of Paraguay issued its own No Promo Homo edict this week. The Ministry of Education ordered public schools to stop using materials to teach what it called gender ideology and to instead focus on traditional values and the supremacy of the traditional family. Saying that gender is a problematic social construct, Education Minister Enrique Riera also promised to burn any books that propagate gender ideology. Somos Gay, a Paraguayan LGBTQ advocacy organization, charged that the term gender ideology was invented by conservative groups to keep justifying violence and discrimination against women and LGBTI people.
No one in Morocco seems to recognize the irony of the North African nation's human rights minister calling gay people scum. Mustafa Ramid used the insulting Arabic word asak, which translates to trash, dirt, or scum, when asked by a reporter at a conference last month about the treatment of LGBT people in his country. He stood by his remarks this week on Facebook, calling homosexuality a perversion that disgusts the public opinion. He claimed that he wasn't against homosexual people, just opposed to how they make love. Homosexual acts are a criminal offense in Morocco. The country's Association of Human Rights and the Association for the Fight Against AIDS were among several national groups to charge that Ramid's words encourage homophobia, and in a government complaint called them flagrant violations of the Moroccan Constitution, which in its preamble adopts the commitment of the Moroccan state to human rights as recognized internationally. This is not the first time Ramid has made controversial remarks about lesbians and gay men. He said during a 2015 radio interview that homosexuals should have a sex change if they want to obey the law.
But, to mix metaphors, there may finally be a light at the end of the bathroom stall in the U.S. state of North Carolina. Democratic Governor Roy Cooper announced a proposed settlement this week with the American Civil Liberties Union and their transgender plaintiffs who sued the state over the original so-called bathroom bill, HB2, and then its so-called compromise replacement, HB 142. The ersatz fix still makes it difficult for trans people to use the restroom or other sex-segregated public facilities that match their gender identity, and prohibits local jurisdictions from passing ordinances to protect their LGBT residents from discrimination. The settlement still needs to be approved by the federal judge overseeing the lawsuit. The state's well-publicized bias has cost it several million dollars in lost tourist income and prompted boycotts by entertainers, professional and collegiate sports associations, and businesses and philanthropic groups. Leaders of both chambers of the state legislature, dominated by Republicans, accused the governor of violating the agreement he reached with them that led to passage of HB 142 earlier this year. But Governor Cooper told reporters that he was anxious to put the bathroom controversy in the state's rearview mirror. He also announced an executive order prohibiting cabinet-level departments under his control, including their contractors, from discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. The governor's office said the order would affect 55,000 state employees and 3,000 vendors for up to $1.5 billion in contracts. "My ultimate goal," he told reporters, "is a statewide non-discrimination law with broad protections, and I will keep striving for it." Trans man Joaquin Carsano, the lead plaintiff in the lawsuit, described the agreement as an important step for LGBT rights in the state. "Nothing can make up for the cruel and senseless attacks transgender people have faced in North Carolina," he said. "But I am hopeful that the court will agree to clarify the law so that we can live our lives in less fear." The state university system and legislative leaders, also defendants in the case, didn't sign the proposed consent decree and could file a legal challenge if the judge approves it.
And finally, political pundits and queer rights activists will be following the election returns this November of a U.S. state legislative race. Local campaigns generally don't attract this much national attention, but this one, in the state of Virginia, pits a longtime far-right Republican incumbent with a lengthy anti-queer record, including being the lead sponsor of a failed bathroom bill there, and his transgender Democratic challenger. If she succeeds in unseating Delegate Bob Marshall, Danica Rome would become the first transgender state lawmaker in U.S. history. Marshall has held his seat for 26 years. In an interview in September with a conservative talk radio show host, he insultingly referred to his 33-year-old challenger only by her first name and said that Danica clearly is out here to show that you can engage in this behavior, which clearly goes against the laws of nature and nature's God, and hold public office to make decisions on behalf of the common good. That is what is kind of at stake here, he said. Rome says her many years working as a newspaper reporter in the region have made her uniquely informed to tackle local issues. She also hasn't shied away from talking about her gender identity, saying she wants to be a role model for LGBT young people. Dawn Shaw, a local Democratic leader in Prince William County, which is an outlying suburb of Washington, D.C., thinks voters are ready for a change after so many years of Marshall's hardline conservative politics and blatant anti-queer bigotry. He noted that Hillary Clinton carried the district last November by a 54-40% margin over Donald Trump. The former reality show star has become such a political pariah as president that few Republican candidates are asking him to campaign locally on their behalf, or even for his simple endorsement. To quote the alleged moron in chief,
"It's a little bit sad."
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 21st, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
We have two things to focus on at the moment. One is getting absolutely every vote for equality back in, and the other is really focusing our attention on the government.
All those fears about the sky falling, all that's going to happen is that people are going to be able to have their happiness and their love recognised.
It's the plebiscite's final push down under later in the program. But first...
Should I stay or should I go?
Fallout from the gut-wrenching move to ban trans people from the U.S. military is spreading, and queer youth from the Outcasting crew are feeling it.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Nisia, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Quinn talks about President Trump's decision to ban transgender people from serving in the military. For reasons of privacy, Quinn preferred not to have his voice heard, so Outcaster Max tells the story.
On July 26, 2017, President Donald Trump announced on his Twitter account that after consulting with his generals, he decided that transgender individuals would not be allowed to serve in the military in any capacity. To back up this decision, Trump cited the tremendous costs involved in providing medical care and services for transgender people. However, a number of published studies completely debunk this claim. The RAND Corporation did a study that was commissioned by the Pentagon. It determined that the actual cost of healthcare for all of the transgender people in the military is between $2 and $8 million annually. That's just 0.13% of the military's healthcare budget. Let's put that into further perspective. The Military Times found that the military spends approximately $84 million per year on Viagra, 10 to 40 times as much as care for transgender service members. So cost isn't the real issue. It's clear that the president's decision to ban transgender people from the military is a bone he's throwing to his base, a blatant attempt to violate and disrupt the rights of transgender people in America, hidden under the guise of improving the effectiveness of the military. The military has the largest budget of any American government program by far, with well over 1 million active members. The idea that a few thousand individuals could cause such a disruption that they'd need to be banned is preposterous. I'm transgender, and I was devastated when I heard this news. It made me feel like there was something wrong with me, causing me to be incapable of protecting my own country. When I vocalized my thoughts about this to my family, they shut me down and justified Trump's decision, saying that it's because being trans is a mental illness. Since Trump announced the ban, he has received widespread criticism, including from members of his own administration. According to an article posted on newnownext.com, Senator John McCain stated, "When less than 1% of Americans are volunteering to join the military, we should welcome all those who are willing and able to serve our country." McCain supports a bipartisan bill to block the ban, along with several other members of Congress. As of now, Trump is asking the Secretaries of Defense and Homeland Security to study the logistics of the ban so that it can take effect in February of 2018. The Department of Defense released an interim guidance document that outlined the temporary plan until February. In it, the department stated that new transgender individuals wouldn't be admitted as they did not meet medical standards. It further stated that after March 22, 2018, no gender-confirming surgeries will be provided for service members. Current members will not be ousted for being transgender. Trans members whose time in the military ends will be allowed to re-enlist, at least until the official plan takes effect. Whether these procedures will remain as they are is uncertain. The ban is still subject to much change, because Trump stated that he could be persuaded that a change to this policy is warranted. Knowing that the ban is a possible result of a prejudice against transgender individuals makes it hard for many of us to feel safe in our own identity. Although it's clear to me that being transgender makes me no less capable than others, I still feel belittled by my own president and government.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is heard online at outcastingmedia.org, on iTunes, and on more than 50 public radio stations around the country. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out.
October the 21st, we're a couple of weeks away from the result.
This Way Out correspondent Barry McKay was on the scene in Sydney for his hometown's Get Out the Vote marriage equality rally, just one of the huge Yes campaign events held in major cities across Australia over the weekend. Among the 15,000 supporters there to inspire people who still have not mailed back their ballots in the non-binding, non-compulsory postal plebiscite, Barry spoke with three key activists, starting with South Australia Green Party Senator Sarah Hanson-Young.
What do you think are the priorities now to win this?
Well, there are still 4 million votes that haven't been cast. But then it's going to be a battle in the parliament. And that's where a strong yes vote is really going to matter. Politicians back in Canberra, my colleagues are going to have to do the right thing. I think the yes vote will get through. We now need to make sure a bill passes the parliament.
What things are you expecting are going to be problematic in Parliament?
Well, there is, of course, pushback already about what type of religious protections and exemptions should be included. The reality is the majority of the Parliament has already agreed to those things. Churches won't be forced to marry people that they don't want to. There's no suggestion that any of that would change. I think the No campaign are desperate to derail, but I don't think they're going to win.
Ireland was the first country to open civil marriage to same-gender couples through a popular vote, and Tiernan Brady brought what he learned in the campaign there to help lead the Yes forces in Australia.
Do we know what the percentage of ballots returned is at the moment?
Well, the current percentage returned is about 68%, which is a phenomenal response. It means we're probably on target for a 70-75% turnout, you know, which means more people have voted on marriage equality in Australia than voted for the American president or the French presidential elections. So that's a sign of how serious people are taking this and how important they realize it is. This is a vote about real people's lives and their dignity and whether the law should treat them equally. And I'm hopeful that the large turnout's a really positive sign.
Things are looking up though, aren't they?
I think the yes side have definitely won the argument, but we have to make sure that the result reflects that. And that's about getting the turnout as high as it possibly can go. I think the real story of this though is, you know, there's a million people out there who are just telling their stories, you know, standing up with great dignity, you know, and respect, and they're winning the hearts and minds of Australia, you know, and when we look back on this, hopefully we see that they were the people that changed everything.
Kat Rose of the group Community Action Against Homophobia was one of the rally organizers.
We have two things to focus on at the moment. One is getting absolutely every vote for equality back in, and the other is really focusing our attention on the government, because we know that we've won popular support in Australia. We have for a long time, and now that support has become active in a really overwhelming way. But still, there are a lot of people in government who are determined to stop equality from passing in a meaningful way. So we need to make sure that what's passed is real equality, and that they don't sneak some other discriminatory laws back in some other way.
This Way Out's Barry McKay picked up those interviews at Sydney's October 21st Marriage Equality Rally. November 7th is the deadline for ballots to be received by the Australian Bureau of Statistics, which is conducting the postal plebiscite. The results will be announced on November 15th. Then, as several queer activists have noted, the real work will begin, maneuvering a marriage equality bill without crippling exemptions through Parliament.
Homophobia, the worst disease. You can't love who you want to love in times like these. Homophobia, the worst disease. You can't love who you want to love in times like these.
The progression and treatment of that disease is the subject of a book edited by Macquarie University professor and Sydney Pride History Group president Shirlene Robinson called Homophobia, an Australian History. She talked with our Barry McKay about the past and the plebiscite.
Australia, I think, like a lot of countries, unfortunately, does have a history of treating LGBTIQ people quite badly until quite recently. It actually wasn't until 1997 that Tasmania became the last part of Australia to decriminalise sex between men. And certainly, I think, for people in the 1950s and the 1960s, whether they were men who feared perhaps being arrested by the police for just their own personal behaviour, or whether it was women who had to live a life of secrecy just because of who they loved, there is unfortunately a history of people experiencing homophobia and discrimination that did continue, I think, in a lot of our history.
I asked Shirlene Robinson how the history of homophobia in this country ties in with Australia being a late bloomer when it comes to the introduction of marriage equality.
Well, Australia is a very unique country in a sense, because there is more support for marriage equality here than there has been in a lot of countries that have already passed marriage equality. So you could say that a lot of prejudices that were once unfortunately held quite strongly have been eradicated. And that's not to say that there are not still people who have experienced homophobia and transphobia, but I think that we have come a long way. I think that one of the barriers in Australia has been that politicians haven't really reflected the will of the Australian people. There are some politicians who have said that they do believe that marriage is between a man and a woman, that their views are very deeply held and that they won't change those views. But we have also seen other politicians think through this issue and evolve on this particular issue. So, for example, we have a situation where actually leaders on both sides of Australian politics say that they support marriage equality. So we don't have to have a postal survey, but for reasons of internal politics, we find ourselves in this situation.
I further asked Shirlene Robinson if she thought there was any political capital in espousing homophobic views publicly, such as members of the far right of the current government are doing in the marriage equality debate.
I think that there was certainly a time in Australian history when expressing homophobic views would have brought you political capital. So, for example, I grew up in Queensland in the 1980s, and we had a premier who was known for his terrible homophobia. When HIV and AIDS came to Queensland, the way that he would talk about people who were gay or people who were living with HIV and AIDS was just absolutely appalling. But I believe now that there may be small, very small pockets of prejudice. Unfortunately, we can't say that we've eradicated racism as much as I would like to think that we have, but we have come a long way. Obviously there are still small pockets of people who may perhaps have prejudices. If you look at the movement for marriage equality, this is not something that really has been championed or spearheaded by politicians in Australia. This is something that actually has been driven by grassroots people, and I think it's one of the great achievements of LGBTIQ people and their friends and families and supporters, because they really kept this going and drove this when politicians didn't really talk about it.
So in Australia, there's a different legal framework to the United States where there's a Bill of Rights. How does that affect issues such as marriage equality?
When the Supreme Court in the United States ruled on marriage equality, they were able to draw from their constitution, which talked about individual liberties and rights. Because we don't have a Bill of Rights here, that means that really the only way to resolve marriage equality in this country is to have that vote in Parliament.
Looking at Canada and New Zealand, two other, I guess, Commonwealth countries with very similar histories to Australia, how were they able to manage marriage equality way before we were?
For Canada, it sort of it did happen quite quickly, and it's one of their proud reforms, I think, is that they do have that very proud international early history. And they had a more of a human rights framework that they were able to draw from, sort of protections that we don't have in Australia exist in Canada. New Zealand had a wonderful achievement when it ushered in marriage equality, and I think that they were really fortunate in that Louisa Wall put a bill into a hat, essentially. You know, things are drawn out at random, and that bill was drawn out of the hat, and it was able to move onto the floor of Parliament, and it was able to be passed. And in Australia, the process of getting a bill onto the floor of Parliament can be, we don't have that sort of random element to it.
In New Zealand, a Christian fundamentalist was saying, you know, the world was going to fall apart and so forth. I mean, that's similar to what, you know, what we're hearing here in Australia. What sort of parallels are there on those fronts between what happened in New Zealand and in Australia?
Well, I think that you'll always have fringes, extremist fringes, and I think one of the most satisfying things about seeing marriage equality happen in New Zealand has been that you've been able to see that the overall outcome has just been that more happy same-sex couples are able to have their relationships and their love recognised, and that all those fears about the sky falling and so on just haven't come to fruition. So, of course, in Australia there will be people on the fringes who will say these things, and I'm very much hoping that we can show them that there is nothing to fear, and that all that's going to happen is that people are going to be able to have their happiness and their love recognised.
With thanks to Sherlene Robinson from Macquarie University in Sydney, I'm Barry Mackay in Sydney for This Way Out.
It's the end of the world as we know it.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Michael LeBeau and Sarah Sweeney, produced by Steve Pride, the Outcasting Queer Youth Radio Crew, produced by Mark Sophos, and from Barry McKay. Carly Simon, Chumbawamba, and REM performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on CKLU Sudbury, Ontario, Boise Community Radio, Boise, Idaho, WHAV, Haverhill, Massachusetts, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.